selfless maiden slip by my side, uttering words about a turning tide, and she slowly furnishes my continuous ride, twirling sanitary bits of hide, hair quite long and lavender dyed, split nostrils hovering open wide, velvet breath with crimson legs astride, issuing words about turning tide, and she asked me if I can ever provide transparent radiation. My liquid head open to the rain, I waltz through a bushel and a peck of grain, and I hear in my ear a hurricane, and I speak to the man about a train, touch with my hand an aeroplane, eyes wide open on the coast of Maine, red signs outside which I contain, coin heavy limbs hoping for to gain some sensuality that I can't explain, transparent radiation. Tables bearing the fruits of Lent, styrofoam people quite violent, clear light blowing right out of my tent, ozone over our continent, expert men not knowing what they meant, they all eat babies for nourishment, funny bird with a forehead bent, slogans tell me that I can rent, yes they say that I can rent, transparent radiation, transparent radiation.
Oh, what did we finish there with? What was that? Oh, yeah. God, it was... Oh! Red Crayola. That's what we did.
What?
Red Crayola finished that set with a demo version of Transparent Radiation, which turned up on that thing that Sonic Boom put together, Space Lines. ADN Crystal before that from Minilab, Weissensee Generator. Before that, Chris Immler from the 7-inch. We heard Tanzen. The Wake did Scan 45 from the On Our Honeymoon 7-inch. 10 Tricks Point Never, a nice bit of skipping CD action. The LP is called Replica. We heard a track called Sleep Dealer. Arthur Lyman did Love Dance from Taboo Volume 2. Neymato Grosso from 1974 7-inch. We heard 1964 2. The next opened that set with Rum Jungle from Mindset, and that's everything we heard. I thank you for staying with me and listening today. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope Worldwide, WFMU.org. My name's Scott, and I'll see you next week. Stay tuned. Too Much Information with Benjamin Walker is coming right up. Bye.
We'll be right back.
$500 and more per week, performing a variety of jobs and crafts for many different companies in the comfort of your own home. You can work full or part-time and at your own pace. These jobs are geared for both men and women. Most companies require absolutely no experience and will supply you with all materials necessary to begin immediately. These national companies are solid and have been around for years, paying out huge sums of money to people just like you. For example, make glamorous hair bows with the materials supplied by this company, and they will pay you up to $374 per week. Work with wood. Earn up to $404 a week assembling wood note holders that take minutes to complete, and you could have a check within 48 hours. These are just a few of over 80 companies ready to offer you home employment. If this idea of working out of your own home is appealing to you and you are eager to get started, we will provide you with The Road to Home Employment, a complete home employment guide, which will tell you who these companies are and how to contact them, a brief description of the job, and the estimated amount of money you could make. Order The Road to Home Employment for the low price of $19.95, plus $5 shipping and handling, and start down the path of financial freedom. This is a no-risk offer. If you are not completely satisfied, send back the guide within 60 days for a full refund. Just leave your name, address, and zip code clearly after the tone. Be sure to speak slowly and spell any difficult words. Your guide will arrive in 3 to 4 business days. Order now.
After you have finished recording, press the pound sign for additional options. Here is the tone.
When it comes to making stuff at home, I am an expert. I don't want to sound like a braggart, but as far as those hair bows and wooden note card holders go, I could make those for you in my sleep, with my hands tied behind my back, blindfolded. I've always been good at making stuff. When I was 5 years old, I made myself a mom. Using a curling iron, a pink terry cloth bathrobe, 2 packages of marshmallows, and a 1968 nylon-stringed acoustic guitar, I built myself a mom. And this mom was always there to pick me up after school. She sang me Bob Dylan songs every night before bed, and she was always brushing her fingers through my hair and leaving me little notes in my pockets. But best of all, she never made me read the Bible. In fact, we never once had to talk about Jesus and how he was going to make me burn in hell for all of eternity. She was the perfect mom. I made myself a dad to go with her. Using a leather-bound copy of Sun Tzu's The Art of War, a package of Swifties pipe cleaners, a bottle of German sherry, and the tailpipe of a 1965 Ford Mustang, I built a dad who never once, not even indirectly, blamed me for ruining his life. And I built them both at home. Unfortunately, though, there were serious electromagnetic incompatibilities. And one morning, I awoke to discover a slag heap of burnt catgut, greasy diagrams of battle formations, and scraps of metal. When I was 12, I made my very own god. Using cereal boxes, extension cords, prescription-strength acne medication, and a giant fuzzy Darth Vader pillow, I built God. But unfortunately, before I could work out all the kinks, I hit puberty, and God was moved to the back burner, on which he burned. But if you want, I can make you another one. Like I said, I can make all sorts of stuff at home. And that's why I've called you tonight. You see, I came across your advertisement at the laundromat. Now, normally, I don't bother with these sorts of things, but, well, there was something about your handwriting, something your voice corroborates. You are the prophet for whom this roadside breakdown has been waiting for his whole life. But, well, there's just one thing. And it's not the $19.95 plus $5 shipping and handling fee. That is a small pittance considering what you are offering.
I look forward to giving you my $19.95 plus $5 shipping and handling fee, for I have no doubt that you will soon have me gunning down the road to home employment in a new car with a full tank of gas. I know that $19.95 plus $5 shipping and handling fee means that you will never let me down, never leave my side. If I need directions, you'll be there, folded up in the glove compartment. And if I ever break down, you will be my AAA. The only thing that bothers me are the hair bows and the wooden note card holders. Now, I understand, of course, that you just can't expect people to buy any old stuff made at home. But I know myself, and hair bows and wooden note card holders are out of the question. I hope you understand. There just has to be something else I can make for you. There's just gotta be. Allow me to say it again. I am very good at making stuff. It shouldn't be difficult for you to help me. In fact, I bet you could do it with your eyes closed, with your hands tied behind your back, in your sleep. A couple of weeks ago, I made myself a penis. Using cottage cheese, a slinky, and a compact hairdryer, I made a penis that puts all those ones you see advertised on the internets to shame. My penis delivers nothing but pleasure. Whenever I go out, it always attracts attention. Everywhere I go, women and men want to touch it. For not only is my penis capable of hitting the G-spot, but it can reach the I-spot as well. At the risk of making you blush, I offer you a demonstration anytime you want. Now, I hope you don't get the impression that the computer revolution caught me with my hands down my pants. Far from it. I'm very good with computers. In the past few years, I've made in my home a handheld word processing device, a desktop tower complete with filing cabinets and drawers, and a toilet-top computer capable of generating virtually real bathroom attendants and go-go dancers. I've also designed and implemented a search engine that provides answers to all the really important questions, like, if I win the lottery, will she dump him and come back to me? Can one be homeless and still have sex? Does love even exist outside of the monetary system? Do we have to worry about any of this crap in the afterlife? And if so, do they offer unemployment in the void? Is there anybody out there?
That there's a difference between making a living and making art. It involves immortality. In fact, I will be immortal.
So you're telling me that a lifetime of pain and suffering is immaterial because when you die, you will be immortal.
I have a chest full of old cassette CDs, my shows. You know, all my life's work is in my drawers, cassettes, CDs.
Uh-huh.
But I'll have to die for them to recognize my genius, and I don't mind.
Yeah, but what if when you die, your landlord comes in and says, "Ah, look at all this garbage," and then takes all your drawers of tape cassettes and dumps them in the street?
I'm going to archive. I have a huge project right now going on with the archiving cassettes. You're on some.
Well, I guess then I have nothing to worry about when it comes to immortality. But here on the mortal plane, Peter, I have some good news. The show is now airing in San Francisco.
And how was it received? Did the people like it?
You know, I've actually already gotten a bunch of really nice emails. But I'm really glad that you asked me that, because Everybody else, every single one of my so-called friends only wants to know something else.
But let me guess. Can I guess?
Sure.
Oh, you're making money now?
Bingo.
Are you obligated to answer that?
I want
to
answer with my
fists. They're dragging you down. It's just awful that people think that your value is how much money you make. The show is only as good as how much money you made off it. I mean, it's...
Yeah, but what's killing me about this is that all of my friends already know. They already know that the show has nothing to do with money. There is no money. This is public radio. I work at a volunteer radio station. So it's almost like it's a put-down.
Ah.
It's like their way of saying, oh, you think you're special. Let me remind you how insignificant you are. Let me remind you what a loser you are.
This is what
Let
you have
me
to,
remind you
instead
what
of raging
a
out,
nobody you
ben
are.
Walker, instead of having this kind of rage, I would say that when you get paid for doing art, you know it's going to suck because you are going to be told to make it suck. Water that down. Make that for the masses. We've got focus groups. Don't say that. The opposite is true. If you make money doing art, then you have compromised, sometimes to the degree where you're doing something absolutely the opposite of what you want to.
Yeah, but part of being an adult in society is making compromises. And if you want to do your own thing, then you can't just expect people to, you know, start throwing money at you. And I'm okay with that. I'm 100% okay with this. But what I'm not okay with is people giving me shit.
Okay, here's something to make you less angry. Rage is better than being depressed.
But I'm swinging back and forth between rage and depression. I have
yeah,
both.
Swing. Right. Rage is... How about no depression, no rage? You know, radio rage and road rage are the same thing. It's the immediate... It's being concerned with the immediate and dwelling on it when uh-huh. it's going to pass... In seconds. It used to be railroad rage. And before that, it used to be walking rage when people would bump into each other. What causes the rage is a comment, like, do you make money? Is a thought, maybe an internal dialogue. But they all pass because you end up getting back to your creative work. And then you feel like yourself again. And that's who you are.
Oh.
That's your food. That's your water.
Uh-oh.
And people... You have that. A lot of people don't even know. They don't have a hobby. Have you met them?
Oh,
people that don't
I've fallen so far.
Music.
I've fallen so far that I'm taking life advice from Peter Joyce.
And here's another thing. Look, remember that guy that was on PPS? You introduced him to me. He has books. He was up in his attic just making these crazy wars. But he was voluminous.
You're thinking of Henry Darger.
Yes, Henry Darger.
Henry Darger was a janitor.
It doesn't matter.
I don't want to be a janitor.
See, I've been a janitor. You know what I was doing when I was a janitor? I wasn't being bothered by their data entry. My thoughts were free. I was wearing I had a Walkman on. I was rocking out. I was thinking my own thoughts. I was going to the bathroom a lot. I was high-fiving the other guy. I hate having my brain filled up with corporate thoughts, and I would always get fired if it was one of those jobs that were better paid, you know, the office job. No. For 8 hours, I can't be me, and I can't not be me.
So you're saying maybe I should look into a side job as a janitor?
Okay, I'll tell you my secret. Remember, when you're enraged or if you're depressed, at least you're not married. At least you don't have a relationship of two where she says, you're not listening to me. Because you can have your own thoughts that should elevate you.
So you're saying I can actually, instead of saying to myself, oh, she picked the guy with the job and not me, and instead of crying, instead of laying face down on the floor every day saying, oh, if only maybe I wasn't a total broke loser, maybe
right.
she would have chosen me instead of him. You're saying I can feel better
you're
about myself.
You're younger than me. I'll tell you what it is. Instead of being a loser, I am over 50, and I wanted to fall in love and get married, and I used to be so depressed. Then I realized it's me that I wouldn't, you know, people, I wouldn't let them get that close. I would not let my lovers, you know, I would let them go if they were serious after about 2 months of fun. And then I would really think, why aren't I in a relationship? Because I value my hobby too much. Every person in a relationship, male or female, says, you don't listen. And I don't.
So,
I think about the world. I think about Rubia.
Peter, does one live with a hobby that takes a lot of time to do?
You know the answer already. Do you want to guess? One word. Starts with a D.
Denial.
Disability.
The family thing does seem to be the most difficult balancing act for creative people. Philip K. Dick tried it 5 times. One of his ex-wives and Dick wrote a memoir about the time she spent with Philip in the 1960s in Point Reyes, California. The book is called The Search for Philip K. Dick, and in a new edition, she writes something really interesting in the afterword. She says, a frequent view of the male writer or artist is that it's difficult for him to function in a bourgeois marriage. The house, the children, the grocery shopping, the car, the bluebirds troop, going to church, going to the beach, birthday parties, the children's colds. But Phil seemed to love all this and used it happily in his writing. Ann Dick still lives in Point Reyes, and so I got her on the phone to ask her about this passage and talk with her about her book and her memories of Philip.
Really, the whole marriage was very pleasant relationship with a man who was very entertaining and affectionate and responsive, and admiring. He admired me a lot and said flattered me, and he was very nice to the children, lovely to the children, and he helped cook, and he mopped the kitchen floor, and he did the dishes. He had some special magic.
Now, the time you guys spent together was a very fertile period for him. Philip wrote 2 of his most famous books, The Man in the High Castle and The 3 Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, but he also wrote countless short stories and about 6 other books as well. How did he find the time?
Yes, it's really amazing, everything that he was doing at that period. He was writing on a regular schedule, 5 days a week, 40 hours a week, 9 to 5, because that's what I wanted him to do. I wanted him to be home for dinner. At the very, very first, he was writing at night, and he'd come home for lunch, and we'd have lunch together. That was quite delightful. And we'd talk about deep philosophical subjects of one kind or another.
Did he ever say, I want to write more?
No, I think he was perfectly happy doing that, and he was doing what he wanted. His idea was to write 2 novels a year, and then he might write a few short stories too. But he was keeping to that schedule, and that actually was the same schedule that he'd been on in Berkeley when he was married to Cleo, who was coming out with about 2 novels a year.
Now, one of the primary themes in Philip K. Dick is that things are not as they appear.
Yeah.
And it seems, Anne, that you almost experienced this for yourself.
Well, you know what I'm thinking about now? He wrote a short story at the after, as we were getting divorced, or after we got a divorce, about a man who goes to the airport to meet his family, who are, you know, coming in, you know, on an airplane, and he meets them, and it's not his family at all. They're proxers, you know, and the proxers were a metaphor for hostile aliens who inhabited the bodies of human beings. And of course, everything he wrote was autobiography. And I think that's going to be, 100 years from now, that's going to be the most interesting thing to scholars.
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, and that's why it's so fascinating talking with you, because so much of, you know, your life in this place and your family and yourself shows up in the books that he's writing at this time.
But it shows up very darkly sometimes, right?
Yeah. But what was it like for you when Phil would ask you to read these books? Can you talk about, for example, what it was like reading Confessions of a Crap Artist, where there's a very dark character pretty much based on you?
Oh, yeah, reading Confessions of a Crap Artist.
Exactly.
Well, we had just come back from getting married, and Philip had been working on this book, and he brought it to me to read. He was really, you know, pleased with himself. He'd finished this book, and here I was the first person to read it, and I was very impressed with myself for that. And here is this portrait of me, sort of me, and not exactly me, that was simply horrible. This woman was just awful. I was stunned. I didn't know what to do with it. So I didn't do anything. I just said, oh, that's a very nice book, or something like that, some dumb thing.
Really?
And went on from there. But it was, I was really surprised. And and then later on, I sort of got used to being a dark, horrible female figure.
Well, you do turn up in a number of the books from this period, but you also seem to be responsible for how many of Phil's male characters view their wives.
Yeah, yeah.
And I found it very interesting in your memoir when you talked about how you would sometimes introduce Phil to your friends as Richard, who was your first husband, and you would joke that one husband is the same as another.
I know, that was sort of sad that he got that idea, you know, and I think he got that from that dumb psychiatrist that we went to, who said, oh, and if she wanted a husband, she'd just go out and buy the best one she could, or something like that. And that really stuck in Philip's mind, and he really sort of adopted that as a theory, which was sort of a shame.
You know, it was fascinating to learn that Dr. A, who also shows up in many of Phil's books of the period, was also a real doctor, a real psychiatrist for you both. But the main reason I wanted to talk to you, Anne, was to ask you about something that you write in the afterword to your book. You write, a frequent view of the male writer or artist is that it is difficult for him to function in a bourgeois marriage. The house, the children, the grocery shopping, the car, the bluebirds troop, going to church, going to the beach, birthday parties, the children's colds. But Phil seemed to love all this and used it happily in his writing. And I feel like I'm missing something. I don't understand where you get happily.
Didn't he have a lot of family scenes here and there in his writing? It seems to me he did.
Yeah, but he also has a man who punches his wife for making him go to the grocery store for him.
Yeah, I don't remember that. But
That's in Confessions of a Crap Artist. Remember, for Faye?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I'll tell you what, one woman that did fascinate me was in that movie, that French movie, Bardo.
Yes, this is the movie based on Confessions of a Crap Artist.
Did you see that?
I did.
Well, here is this good-looking blonde woman, and I love that, you know, sort of being in the movies or being portrayed in the movies, or some aspect of myself being portrayed in the movies. That was lots of fun.
Yeah, but I still don't understand why you would say that Phil didn't have a difficulty with trying to balance out the writing and the bourgeois family life.
No, no, I think he did have it, but he just worked really hard at fulfilling the role of the husband and doing his beloved writing. His writing really was part of his being, or was his being. And I think that he did like the role of the bourgeois husband, but I think it was all too much for him. I don't think he could. I think a man that made a lot of money writing could handle it, you know. But
so you think money was the real problem?
Yeah, and I wasn't the frugal I was extravagant person rather than frugal, and I'm sure that I wasn't very helpful to Philip in terms of saving every penny. And and you know, he'd lived at a very, very low financial level before he met me.
Yeah.
I mean, the horse meat level, you know. keeping a middle class household. I'm riding myself now, and I don't do a bit of housework, and I can see, you know, the picture of the bohemian artist. Why, you have to be. If you get all involved with keeping house all the time, you don't have any time left over or creativity to do anything.
Well, to be fair, I think this is one of the main reasons so many of the male characters in Phil's books from this period are resentful towards their wives.
Yeah, maybe. I didn't quite catch that, but you may be right. You know, I'm not very good at money, so I can't talk about it.
Well, I'm not either, Anne, so we are on the same page. But thank you so much for taking the time out to talk to me.
Okay, bye-bye.
A couple of weeks ago, I got a call from one of the largest Wall Street firms to come up to New York and participate in a special project.
Why would they call you? You don't have anything to do with finance.
Well, I get a lot of calls like this.
Why?
Well, that's how it works. Industry is always interested in plugging in government guys. So that's how I ended up participating in this Wall Street focus group.
You said yes?
Well, it was the night out at Scores.
What?
Yeah, this is what they told me on the phone. Apparently, Scores is where all the new and exotic financial instruments get invented. The, you know, the normal ones, the plain vanilla ones, they get made back at the office. But the really exciting ones are actually made in strip clubs.
So you're saying that Wall Street now has the balls that they can just call up ex-government employees and offer them a free night out on the town at a strip club?
Dude, they won. They all got off scot-free. All the guys that completely imploded the economy. The Justice Department isn't prosecuting any of them. So they have our tax dollars, they have full immunity, and they are ready to party.
So why are they even calling any ex-government employees?
Well, my theory is that, yeah, they won. They got all the money. They can do whatever they want. They know they're not going to go to jail, but they really hated the finger pointing. They're looking for more friends of friends, I guess.
And now you're signing up to be one of their new friends?
No. Sometimes when the system fails, it's up to one man to make things right.
Oh, of course. This is about truth and justice. I forgot.
No, payback. I arrive at the club and I'm just told to like give a name to the door people, and they walk me through the club into this back room. And I'm looking around, and there's, you know, strippers and stuff everywhere, and I notice actually a few people that I recognize from DC, but mostly it's Wall Street guys, you know, the Wall Street look. They're walking around with their really expensive shirts and ties with their sleeves rolled up and stuff, and smoking cigars and things. So I sit down at this table and I look up at the stage in front of me. There's stages all over the place. There's really, really hot chick dancing on stage. And in front of her, like staring at her, you know, inches away from her, is this huge, huge fat guy. Right? This guy's enormous. And this chick is dancing around. She slips out of her G-string, really sexy, you know, it slides down her thighs and down onto the floor. And she steps out of it, picks up the G-string, and then like whips around and wraps the G-string around his neck a couple times and just squeezes the hell out of it. And I'm just like totally freaked out. I'm watching this guy, and he's red. He goes from beet red to purple, and he's clutching at the G string, trying to get it off, and then wham, he just collapses on the stage. I'm stunned. I don't know what to do. But then he like gets up, and he's actually got this enormous heart on, and he grabs the girl by the arm, and they just walk off through one of the many doors that are along the back wall. Yeah. So then this Wall Street dude comes over. He tries to, like, give me a fist pound. And I'm like, what? And he sits down, and he points over at the stage, and he goes, whoa, hell of a bear squeeze, huh? And I don't even say anything, but I'm kind of like, what? And then he leans in a little bit. He looks at my name tag, which they gave me at the front. He says, oh, you're one of those government guys. You probably don't know about a bear squeeze. A bear squeeze occurs when a share or commodity has been heavily short sold on a strong expectation that it will fall. Instead of which, and he's gesturing to the stage now, it rises.
So, are you...
Remember how I told you that the ordinary financial instruments, the vanilla ones, are created back at the office and the exotic ones are made at the strip club? Well, it turns out they are all based on exotic sex acts. But the interesting thing, you know how on TV when they're trying to explain all these complicated financial instruments and you just cannot understand what yeah. the hell is going on? Yeah. Well, this guy, my new Wall Street friend, he just starts showing me around and he's like pointing at these sex acts. And I'm like, oh, now I understand what the long position is. Oh, of course. That's how a naked option works. Ah, come div. I get it. Then another Wall Street dude sits down next to us and he checks out my name tag too. And he also gets really excited that I'm an ex-government guy. He starts talking to me, telling me all about himself. And turns out this guy is a senior executive at one of Wall Street's largest ratings agencies. So clearly these guys are good buddies. You know, they're like high-fiving, they're clinking glasses, and then they start talking about the wife and kids.
Wait a minute, though. I thought there was supposed to be like a separation between the traders and the ratings people.
Are you retarded?
Sorry.
So it turns out that these two guys are responsible for coming up with the credit default swap. Or at least that's what they tell me. So I'm skeptical, but they just stand up and go grab these three girls. They drag them up on stage and they start acting it out for me. This is just too much. I can't watch it anymore. So I get up and I go to the bar. And I'm walking away and I hear the ratings guy scream out, dude, check this out. It's the floating strike look back option. But I do not turn around. I mean, it's getting to the, I just can't take it at this point. And I almost left, in fact. I was just about to ditch out on Operation Payback. But then this guy comes up to me and he's like, ah, Mr. Chris, we've been expecting you. I'm so glad you're here.
And who is this guy, Mr. Burns?
Nope, it's the CEO of Gold. So he puts his arm around me and explains to me why he's put on this party. He believes that if he can get the right people to help his people design the next generation of financial instruments, then if there's ever a problem, and he literally winks at me when he says this. He winks and he says, next time, if there's a problem with the next generation of exotic financial instruments, then maybe there will be less noise. So I put my drink down and I look him directly in the face and I say, well, you're lucky I'm here then, because I have an idea for the next financial instrument that will make everyone here filthy, filthy rich. The whole bar goes quiet. Everyone is staring at us. His eye starts twitching. I turn to the crowd and I say, "Okay, everyone, I'm going to show you something. It's like the opposite of trickle down. I want you all to pay close attention. This is what I call the money shot."
Ah! Ugh.
What?
I don't want to hear this. I don't want to hear about your sick and twisted deviancy.
What are you talking about?
You just said money shot.
Are you some kind of pervert? I punched him.
Thank you for calling the Work From Home Hotline. We are currently expanding in your area and are looking for individuals to help with our growth. We are the Work From Home business, the only one with a complete, start-to-finish, proven, advanced, and automated system. Our system works regardless of your background. We provide the system, experience, and hands-on training. The only thing we cannot give you, but is required, is that you have the desire and that you are teachable. We know you have some level of desire because you called. Are you teachable? If you are, we have put together a decision package that will help you decide whether our business is or is not for you. The decision package contains approximately 3 hours of information about our home-based business and begins your training. You will receive a manual that explains how, why, and what we are doing, 2 videos where you will meet us and see exactly how our business works, and an audio cassette tape to further help you with your decision. Your decision package also contains the name and telephone number of your personal team leader, who will be working with you on a daily basis, helping you make money in your first week. Obviously, because there is a cost to us for the materials in your decision package, there is a refundable $36 price for the entire package. The $36 is fully refundable if you decide this is not for you. This package is not how we make money working from home. If you are teachable and truly have the desire and ambition to work, then we will train you and work with you, as others have done with us, to help you secure your financial future. Order your decision package today. When it arrives, review everything thoroughly before calling your personal team leader. We are very excited to begin working with you. Thank you and have a great day.
After you have finished recording, press the pound sign for additional options. Here is the tone.
When it comes to desire, I am an expert. In my pursuit of desire, I stop at nothing until the object of my desire is safely in my possession, locked away in the basement, handcuffed to the radiator. I hope that doesn't sound too strong, because the other thing I am is teachable. In fact, that's the primary message I'm hoping to get to you tonight. So scratch that bit about the radiator. What I'm really trying to say is I want to be your dog. I want to fetch your paper. I want to pull your bobsled. And I want to spend my nights curled up at your feet. When you say sit, I will stay. And when you shout jump, I will come. I don't want to sound like a braggart, but I've always been a straight A student. Angst, anxiety, anguish, alienation, agony. But I desire to learn more. And that is why I'm calling you tonight. You see, I came across your advertisement at the laundromat. And normally, I don't bother with these sorts of things. But, well, there was something about your handwriting. Something your voice corroborates. You are the prophet. The mistake I made was assuming you'd come in a more traditional form. I assumed you'd show up wearing a tunic or a turban. I figured you'd have a beard or at least speak in a commanding tone.
It really blows my mind to think that all along you've been living here among us, posing as some slob from a two-bit New Jersey town. But that doesn't matter anymore, because I have found you. My dear team leader, I have found you. And I have no doubt that you will soon have me gunning down that road to home employment in a new car with a full tank of gas. I know that you will never let me down, never leave my side. If I need directions, you will be there, folded up in the glove compartment. And if I ever break down, you will be my AAA. But there's just one thing, and it's not the $36. Oh, that is already on its way to you. And personally, I don't care if that's what fuels your business or your coke habit or your child support payments. I just need you to tell me one thing. It's been a couple of years since I've come across one of those work-from-home advertisements on a lamppost or a wall in a laundromat. Most of these businesses now solicit online. In fact, you probably have a bunch of them in your inbox or your spam folder right now. A few years ago, one of these online work-from-home ads caught the attention of an artist named Chris Collins. There was a name on the ad, Tie Pilot. This turned out to be an alias for a man named Ron Tye. And when Chris Collins found Ron Tye on Facebook, he wrote him a letter.
Dear Mr. Ron Tye, this is going to be a strange email, both for me and you. I have no idea how you'll respond to me writing you out of the blue like this. So let me start off by assuring you that I'm not a creep, a crazy person, or an internet troll. I've been following your work for a long time. A few years ago, while I was looking around the job section of Craigslist, I found an ad describing a work-from-home job. Normally, I disregard a post like this, as these things are usually flagged for spam as soon as they are posted. But for some reason, I clicked. I've seen many posts like this before. It usually says, in vague and optimistic terms, that there are mountains of wealth hiding just beyond the surface of your computer screen, and all it takes to capture your tiny piece is a little bit of hard work and a high-speed internet connection. Usually it offers some sort of challenge to its audience, like, do you have what it takes? If so, click here. These posts feel stilted, detached, and artificial. A collection of buzzwords, loosely constructed into a sentence, as if a computer is talking to another computer through the vast vacuum of space. I don't remember what the actual body of the post says, and an archive of it is probably lost forever in the internet ether. What I do remember is the promotional image that followed. Whereas all the other make-money-from-home posts I'd ever seen had been mechanical, steeped in cliché, and lacking any sort of heart or sincerity, this was the opposite. It was one of the most unique pieces of graphic design I'd ever seen. The image title was hope40.jpg. It looks like it's two businessmen standing in sort of a park with a globe. And then on top of, like superimposed on top of that, it looks like it's the Internet Explorer logo. And they're both holding these cardboard balloons. And one of them says happy, and one of them says successful. And it says click here why, with a question mark and three exclamation points. And then it's signed by Luzi of TyPilot.com. By tracing the image URL, I was directed to a folder that contained over 40 different images, all completely different, all with hope in the title, all promoting TyPilot.com, and they were all signed by a mysterious person named Luzi. This is a pretty cool one. It's a Hope 26, It's a man that's holding up a globe, but the globe is covered in money. And the background of this image is clouds, and there's a text superimposed on everything that says, "You can have everything you want in life if you will just help enough other people what they want. Start your 2008 be a successful year. Click here now." Each image I found was more thrilling than the previous one. They exploded with strange color choices. A graphic designer would look at these compositions and call them horrendous. I found them bizarre, perplexing, and quite beautiful. I once had a friend who, as an adult, started playing piano. He never had any formal training, didn't know how to read music, and knew nothing about music theory. In spite of this, and I'd argue precisely because of this, the compositions he created were some of the most beautiful I'd ever heard. This was not because some sort of innate ability, some sort of mythical muse or genius built into his DNA. It was because he had enthusiasm and wasn't weighed down by the tethers of convention. He didn't know how things were supposed to be done, so he found his own way. This is what I saw in Luzzi's work. I can sense the enthusiasm, the belief in the product, and thus a belief in the power of the internet. Luzzi, like my friend the pianist, was not held back by rules and convention, and was free to just create. The results were sincere and poetic. One of the images said, "Everybody's wanted, everybody's needed, everybody's dreamed. Click here to find out how." The strange thing, though, is when I did click to find out how, and was redirected to typilot.com, there was nothing there. Now, this could have been the end of the story. The internet is forever growing and changing. New connections are made, and old connections die. Domain names expire every day. What's the big deal? But for whatever reason, Luzzi's images stuck with me. I saved a copy of them to my computer, out of fear that they'd soon be deleted. Sometimes I'd forget about them, but I'd always return. I actually became quite protective of these images. I didn't share them with anyone. I feared they would laugh at the spelling, the grammar, the unprofessional quality, and not see them as I did. I felt such an affinity towards these strange and beautiful pictures, and the more I investigated them, the more questions I had. Who is Luzzi? What was TyPilot.com? I needed to dig deeper. I was able to locate a cached version of TyPilot.com at archive.org's Wayback Machine. This revealed the skeleton of a site scattered with dead links and images. The site promoted Global Domains International.
"Welcome to Global Domains International. Your meeting is in the executive conference room. You're right on time. My name is Christy."
"And I'm Michael. We're here to help you get what you want, possibly more than you ever dreamed of."
"Michael is so right. We're about to show you something that could change your life on many levels and truly make you the master of your own domain. Let me show you what I mean with a quick presentation. Oh, feel free to go to our website at any time after this presentation to get more detailed information."
But when I tried to search for more information about this company, I found it very hard to get a straight answer. As far as I can tell, this company purchased exclusive rights from the Western Samoan government to distribute the country's domain extension, WS. It seemed to operate as some sort of pyramid scheme, where you purchase a .ws domain that encourages others to purchase a .ws domain, and so on and so forth, theoretically earning you residual income. Okay, so this one is Hope 44, and it has a woman on the right side, and it was clearly a very small image that was expanded because it's all pixelated and compressed. The woman is holding a big wad of money, and right next to her is a computer. And in a really sort of funky font, it says, "Try, come, and join us for making online income. Click here now." TyPilot.com was no longer active, but additional research led me to a YouTube account with the same username. The name listed on the account was Ron Tai. It was there I found your love letters to Luzzi. I found out that you met online and fell in love. You lived in the States, she in Vietnam.
You gotta back up a little bit. Back up, back
Oceans
up, back up,
apart,
back up. Say,
day
say
after
hi.
Day.
Say hi
and
to the
I slowly go
and
see.
And that's Dad.
I hear your voice on the line, but it doesn't stop the pain.
You exchanged photos and eventually went to visit. You fell deeper in love. You made plans for her to move to the States with you, but things were taking longer than expected. In one video, you promise, next Christmas we'll be together, and it will be amazing.
Hey, sweetheart. Just want to wish you a Merry Christmas. This is a video I just put together. It's a video card. I hope you like it. Next time you come here, it's going to be incredible, baby. Our next Christmas will be incredible. So Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. I love you so much, and I wish you were here for this Christmas, but next year you'll be here.
Is it
bye
my
now, honey. Love you.
You were lying here.
These videos have since been deleted, but comments like, I hope you will fix your problems soon. Your kids deserve to have a mom and dad. Those remain. From these details, I began constructing this heartbreaking story in my head. One of love, the promise of wealth, and of bottoming out, coming up short. It goes like this. Luzi and Ron met online. Despite a significant age difference and thousands of miles between them, they fell fast and deeply in love. They made plans to be together, a plan to bring Luzi from Vietnam to California. They decided to go into business together. The internet seemed like such a magical place to them. After all, through it they'd accomplished the impossible and found each other. Because of this belief, they were seduced by the promises of GDI. Ron would handle the numbers and the technical aspects, and Luzi would create the graphics. They set up shop at TiePilot.com and began attempting to sell .ws domain names. The images Luzi created, the Hope JPEGs, not only served as promotion for their business, but as love letters to Ron, as hopes and prayers for the future, a future that did not come. After pouring a significant amount of time and money into it, Ron and Luzi declared defeat, and TiePilot.com was abandoned and left to expire. I guess the whole reason why I'm writing you all of this is to ask you how the story ends. I've spent years constructing my own story of Ron, Luzi, and TiePilot.com, and GDI, and Western Samoa, yet I've neglected to contact you directly about it. I'm not quite sure why. Maybe I was just concerned I'd freak you out. Also, I'm writing to tell you that I've purchased TiePilot.com, and I'm offering it to you as a gift. I put all of Luzi's Hope JPEGs up there, but I'll give it to you, and you can do whatever you want with it. Sincerely, your internet admirer, Chris Collins.
This episode of Too Much Information is called The Cost of Living Remixed. It was written and produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Sylvie Kovnat and Bill Bowen. And it featured Ann Dick, Chris Collins, and TMI regulars Peter Choice and Chris. There's even more information on the TMI playlist page, and that's where you can subscribe to the TMI podcast. All that at WFMU.org.
Join us at the same time next week for another edition of Too Much Information. You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org. Up next, the Nardwar the Human Serviette radio show. Freedom!
Nardwar! a great big chunk of something light and sweet.
I love to munch. I love to crunch. Peanut brittle, sour pickle, and some candy bars for lunch.
I love cherries. I love berries. They're the apple of my eye. Just the thought makes my mouth water. For mama's homemade pie.
My appetite is out of sight. I love a lot, a great big pot of honey. Day and night, my love for food is almost blue.
So pardon me if I repeat. I love to eat. I love to eat cold tomatoes, hot potatoes. Makes me lick my fingertips.
Just a thought makes my mouth water. For lovely fish and chips.
Some people say I'm no gourmet, but a tasty piece of pastry I would never turn away.
No ifs or buts. From soup to nuts.
I love to eat. I love to eat. I love to eat.
What I could do to a Spanish omelet and for a Spanish onion, I would run a mile. I taste that chili drives me silly, and hot tamale drives me wild. No ifs or buts.
From soup to nuts. My love for food is almost rude, so pardon me if I repeat. I love to eat. I love to eat. I love to eat.
I love to eat.
I love to eat.
I love to eat.
I love to eat.
And you're listening to WFMU, and it's time right now for the Nardwar, the Human Serviette radio show. You just heard right there from the Gentle Ben TV series soundtrack, I Love to Eat. Today on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette radio show, an interview with the Canadian romantic, Robert Dayton, from the bands July 4th Toilet and Can-Am, and now also... he's calling himself the Canadian Romantic. And he's going to be here on the Nardwar to Human Serviette radio show to give you the full scoop on a whole bunch of songs that I'm about to play. And the song I just played, the Gentle Ben soundtrack entrenched, I Love to Eat. So, as I mentioned, here's a bunch of tracks chosen by Robert Dayton, the Canadian romantic, and we'll get into full descriptions and what they're all about when I get to the interview with Rob Dayton, but right now, this is what we're going to hear. We're going to hear another track from the Gentle Ben soundtrack, Whatchamacallit. Then we're going to hear something by Doug Randall from Toronto, Ontario, Song for the Middle Age Ed. Then, something from Vancouver, Canada's Destroyer, Canadian Lover, and of course on the Canadian theme, right after that, gonna hear something by Robert Dayton himself, the Canadian Romantic, with the Canadian Romantic, and then a song all about Rob, written by Tonetta, called, of course, the Canadian Romantic. Here's Whatchamacallit from the Gentle Ben soundtrack on... the Nardwar to Human Serviette radio show on WFMU.
Well, I was walking along like a man can be. When I looked up, and what did I see? It looked like something I'd seen before. But I can't tell you just what I saw.
Can't you tell me what it was you saw?
Well, I'll try. Well, I'll try. I'll try to tell you what I saw.
Was it a bird?
Well, upon my word.
Was it a cat?
Well, do you want to bet?
Was it a red balloon drifting in the sky? What was it that caught your eye?
Yeah, what was it that caught your eye?
Well, I'll try. Well, I'll try. Try to tell you caught my eye.
It was a whatchamacallit.
A whatchamacallit?
Yeah, whatchamacallit.
What's a whatchamacallit?
Well, a whatchamacallit is plain to see. It can be anything that you want it to be. Can be all those things that you've just said.
You mean a bird, a jet, a balloon that's red?
Yeah!
A bird, a jet, a balloon that's red. A whatchamacallit is like making a wish for a frog, you're a dog, you're a flying fish. Just open your eyes is all you gotta do, and a whatchamacallit will do the rest for you.
Whatchamacallit
will open up your mind. You mean a whatchamacallit can open up my mind? A whatchamacallit is plain to see. Can be anything that you want it to be. Can take fire and brimstone, evil and hate, and change it all to love, and even change your fate.
Can take fire and brimstone and evil and hate, and change it all to love, and change my fate.
Yeah.
What you call it puts hope in your heart, makes a dream come true right from the start. So open up your eyes and be aware and kind, and what you call it can open up your mind.
You mean open my eyes and be aware and kind, and what you call it open up your mind?
Yeah, what you call it can open up your mind.
Open up my mind.
Yeah, open up your mind.
Yeah, open up your mind.
Open up my mind.
Yeah, open up your mind.
Yeah, what you call it can open up your mind.
The man looks bewildered. The hair that was gold in the sun